The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi, once again, thank you, thank you. That was Sarita with Sonny and the fabulous Joe Pastrio, and of course, the royal member of the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, introducing yours truly as my opening act on The Tonight Show. It's Monday, 5 p.m., late in the afternoon here in John Barber's World on BBS Radio in Las Vegas. We have had two debates in this city recently from both parties, and after hearing them, I truly wish that commercial were true, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas and does not get to Washington. All of you folks out there who've been screaming that America's been dumbed down are totally and absolutely wrong. You can see from these candidates, America has been dumbed up. We do not need voting for these people. We need IQ tests. Likewise, for most voters, how do you get such idiots in the White House? We should padlock the goddamn place. This morning, President Obama. And don't you just hate it to say that word? Well, this morning, Obama, in talking about Paris, is mouthing Jeb Bush's compliment to his brother, how he protected us from and after 9/11. Which just proves that there is total equality between the races and presidents, because with that comment, Obama proved he's as equal an idiot as George Bush. Never, ever in my life have I ever sworn on stage in my act or on television. It's just not my nature. I don't like to express myself that way, but sometimes you get so enraged at the idiocy running us and ruining us that profanity is the only way to actually express it. I put a picture up 2 days ago on Facebook of George Bush sitting next to his father laughing his head off. That picture and the quote underneath was picked up by a couple of very, very popular talk show hosts, and they put it on their page. And the caption underneath says, quote, "Jesus, Pop, I remember when you said if folks knew what we were doing, really doing, they'd hang us." How fucking stupid they are. I steal an election, lie them into a war, start all this shit over there, walking around free, get $500,000 for a speech. Those fucking idiots. Unbelievable. God bless America. Unquote. Now we have France with our media saying ISIS is running around singing, "I love Paris when it's burning." Well, let's pull back a bit, okay? Don't get sucked into emotionally shocking and awing the Middle East. Bush lied. They all lied. Right-wingers know it. Let's wait and see who is not lying. Let's see if we can find out the real truth behind the real horror. Somebody, somewhere, is trying to control us still and again through catastrophe. Remember Naomi Klein's classic book a few years ago, 2007, Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. As for me, I just wish Don Adams from the old classic Get Smart were on the case in Paris, because I know the first thing he'd say is, "Agent 99, It looks like the old 911 drop the passport trick. I'm going to tell you a truth that may be hard for you to digest, but just think about this, folks. All changes and improvements in society throughout history, from Galileo to Snowden, have come about only because of the truth-seeking black sheep of that society, be it medicine or music or art or science or physics or astronomy or literature. Every improvement is made only by the persistence of these black sheep. Jefferson and Washington in the American Revolution had fewer than 5% of the population on their side. Fidel Castro only had 10 in a rowboat. Jesus only had the Christian Dirty Dozen. While the minority of black sheep are bleeding the truth to the rest of us, the majority of white sheep allow themselves to be controlled. Now get this, by only one shepherd with one goddamn little dog. My closest friend in Canada, Lena Sanek, has the best informed show about the assassination in the world. It's called Black Op Radio. I am actually seriously thinking of changing the name of this show to Black Sheep Radio. Anyway, tonight, I am totally lucky, as you are, to have two people on the show, the brightest voices I know in the country, two of the brightest voices, to shine some light into the dark corners of foggy information about Paris and other calamities befalling the Republic and the planet. After a late break, next to Chris Hedges, the best-informed real journalist I know, our only regular from the Golden State with the golden voice, Joe Satilli. First, though, not only the very brightest voice I know, but the only voice I know who I am totally convinced has actually solved the uninvestigated questions about 911. It is impossible, even though some so-called truthers have tried, it's impossible to penetrate this woman's fortress of facts. Her viral book, Methodical Deception, on every page is shocking, mind-blowing, and mind-expanding. And you can hear her every Saturday night at 6 on her new talk show on Talk Network at 6 p.m. Believe me, it is a privilege to have one of the true voices of America back, Rebecca Robb. Rebecca, thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, John. It's always a pleasure.
The question that I would have to ask you first, are you surprised on two fronts that you still have as much visibility as you have, as much of an audience as you have that seems to be growing constantly, especially with that wonderful talk show you're doing, with the information that you're imparting? And in imparting that information, have you been surprised by pilots or stewardess or mechanics or military personnel seeking you out in confidence and saying that they agree with you?
Yes, I have had lots of airline professionals, military, and people that are involved in the industry, air traffic control and the like. After my second book, Methodical Deception, and that was just released the end of August, I brought some things out in the appendix of that and the whole story. It's a continuation of the first book, Methodical Illusion. And being the first and only airline professional that's ever really done this type of investigation into 9/11 from an insider's viewpoint, it's been overwhelming. And I know you read The Methodical Deception, and in there is an eyewitness to the fact that the planes were taken somewhere remotely and landed at a military base. And the eyewitness, that is her statement, and that is an illegal affidavit. And I have that on a tape recording and also in a legal document safely put away. And I just, about 10 days ago, had another eyewitness to another aircraft, also in Western Massachusetts, going to that Air Force base that was evacuated, and all of the reserves that were called up that morning were locked out for 2 to 3 days. So I'm having, and I have an air traffic controller that's helping me read that. After the first book, I got a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act draws from about a 4 or 5 year period that someone had been getting information. Most of it's from NORAD and the U.S. Air Force and FAA. But it's a variety of things. One of the things that really got me thinking was that Thomas Keene, who was the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, along with the vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission hearings, Lee Hamilton, wrote that they were so frustrated with the repeated misstatements, you can read that as lies, by the Pentagon and the FAA, that the 9/11 Commission considered an investigation into possible deception, which is why I chose that for my title, by these two government agencies. And when I read that, I thought, well, hey, I better look at them. So for the second book, I followed up on a lot of people that should have stopped 9/11.
Rebecca, when you first started this, it must have been sort of something that you were reluctant to do. I mean, you were a stewardess for, or a flight attendant, or whatever you call them, for 38 and some odd years. And you, although you're very bright, you're like an ordinary citizen. You have no position of authority. Whatever made you, whatever compelled you to start, and whatever made you think you might get anywhere?
What compelled me to start was that I was actually researching to write a novel, just a novel about being a flight attendant, and I discovered that about 10 of the hijackers were still alive. And that just stopped me in my tracks. I couldn't believe it. I stopped flying in 2004. I started to write a novel in 2008 or 9. And at that time, when I discovered that, I thought, uh-oh, because I remember thinking cell phones don't work at altitude. And also that some of the things that I was hearing from the media were impossible. The flight attendants were not following the FAA set in stone hijack protocols. And they were saying things and doing things they shouldn't do and weren't doing the things they should have done. And this is something we're trained on every single year. So
when I hear you tell your story, and I listen to you every chance I get nervous and frightened for you because of what you must have felt when you truly discovered that there was an air base north of New York City to which the actual planes were taken. That must have been really frightening for you to pursue and must have given you some sort of pause, like, hey, I don't know if I'm capable of doing this.
Well, what I did was I looked at the phone calls that were made, and I knew that the aircraft had to be on the ground. And I got an FBI transcript from the flight attendants that called in off the first flight, which was American 11. And when Betty Ong, one of the flight attendants, said he, as in one hijacker, he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class and we can't breathe in business class, I knew that they were no longer pressurized, because if you sprayed mace or pepper spray in a pressurized aircraft, everyone, including the hijacker, would have gassed himself and would have been suffering the effects, including whoever was flying the aircraft, because the plane air is recirculated. And so then she said something else that got my attention. She said he stood upstairs, and I knew there's no stairs on that airplane, but I'd been in many big hangars, and I knew that there were stairs in the hangars. And when that happened to me, I literally got sick to my stomach. I thought, no, this can't be right. And then what I did, the next plane came from Boston as well. And it took just a little bit longer than the 20 minutes because it actually circled around. I have their flight plan now because I got a Freedom of Information Act, a draw of about a terabyte of information. So I knew that it was going to take them a little bit longer. They were on a southerly course out of Boston instead of a northerly course like American was. And then what I did was I just thought, well, what time did Barbara Olson call? Let's see how long it took from Dulles in Washington, D.C. And as soon as they landed and probably rolled right into one of those large hangars, she made her phone call and along with a flight attendant from there. And when that all worked, I really got sick to my stomach. I mean, I literally came apart.
Because you had to imagine the horror that had to actually befall those passengers. And you brought up Barbara Olson's name. Do you think Barbara Olson is still alive somewhere?
I do now. When people started asking me that after I wrote my first book, I started to do a little research into her, and I found some really interesting information. One of the most interesting was that her husband, Ted Olson, he was the Solicitor General of the Department of Justice at the time. He immediately was lying about her calling collect from her cell phone, collect from an air phone on board the plane. Both of those were impossible. You cannot call collect from a cell phone. And I found out that American had removed all of their air phones on their 757s, which is what Flight 77 was, 9 months before 9/11. So she couldn't have been calling. So he was obviously lying. But he was also the attorney for the Israeli Mossad spy, Jonathan Pollard. Now, that's not the only connection I found that was really interesting with Barbara Olson. So I think she is probably still alive, and she actually could even be his current wife, Lady Booth. Someone take some fingerprints.
One of the things that I thought when I read your book and about what must have gone on at that airbase, in order for the military or the government to move, how many people were on that base, do you think? 1,000? 1,500?
Actually, I talked to someone that was based there, so I do have a little inside track on that. And after I'd done an interview and I didn't mention the title or the name of the base, she contacted me, and when I got her on the phone, she said, "I know what you're talking about. I was based there, and this is what happened." That was a reserve weekend base only, mainly. And so they rarely flew during the week, but they did have a skeletal crew there. And some of them were civilian employees as well. And maybe they worked the store or the post office or some janitorial service and that type of thing. She said that everyone on that base had been evacuated, and that when they were activated after the second plane hit the South Tower, they were at her unit, the C-5 transport unit. Now, this base has an 11,595-foot runway, and it was a base that had been evacuated, and when they were activated that morning and got to the base, they were all locked out and put up in hotels. And she said, "Until I heard your interview, I never knew why, but it made her sick. Just like when I discovered it, it made her stomach flip over."
Rebecca, have you thought about perhaps going to some of those hotels and asking to see if you could find records of people who stayed there during that time?
No, I haven't really thought about that. I took her word. I mean, she has absolutely no reason to lie to me about it. And plus I've been busy. You know, I put two books out in 9 months. So I've been really busy. And when I got that terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data, there isn't a spare moment that I'm not going through that and making more discoveries. And I'm working now with a team of people, air traffic controllers and pilots and flight attendants that, are able, and some military and some people that worked on special projects like for DARPA. So they're able to look at some of these documents that I have and see things as clearly as I saw the flight attendants weren't following protocol. And so it's been a blessing, and I'm so grateful. I'm working on a third book from the Methodical series, and this should be the end of it, I hope. And then also I'm working on a nonfiction book as well, because people want to know, how did I discover all of this stuff? What I tried to do was eliminate crazy conspiracy theorists and retired old professors that thought they had an idea and would write a book about it. And as I weeded through all of the nonsense, I went for government documents. So I used FBI, DEA, U.S. Air Force, NORAD, National Transportation Safety Board, FAA, documents that I could find, and things that had been put in to the 9/11 commission hearings, as well as the Zachariah Massawi trial.
About the day that it happened, is there any kind of information available? Because when it happened, we all, of course, were glued to our television sets. And what we would always do is we would click from one network to the next network to find their point of view about what was happening. And yet the same images came up on every network. How and why could that have happened?
That's an interesting aspect of 9/11, that there was very limited photography, and they CNN and Fox and all the networks were sharing one portal of which is very unusual for anything. So it's just something for people to think about, that you don't see all of the networks, all of them, sharing a one camera angle only, pretty much. And that was very common that day, which I also thought was very weird too. It was as weird as them telling me that the flight attendants and passengers were making phone calls from 39,000 feet, because I knew that wasn't happening. And I also knew that flight attendants wouldn't call their mothers and fathers and boyfriends or spouses. They would make a phone call to the airline, to a crew scheduler or someone that immediately could hook them in with the air traffic control to start the FAA on the protocol with NORAD to scramble jets and get them safe. So none of that happened, and that's why I kept going back to discovering that. But now that I have been joined by this incredible team, I'm here to tell you, John, and I know you've read both books, that everything in The Methodical Illusion and everything in The Methodical Deception is real. And it's true according to the 9/11 information, and it's all documented on U.S. government documentation.
I have no doubt about any of it, Rebecca. I mean, I believe you're the Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes of this case. Has anyone approached you? I mean, Oliver Stone finally made a movie about Jim Garrison, and it's interesting about, you said you got sick to your stomach when you began to realize some of the things that you were uncovering. My mentor in this business was Red Fox, and he had a great line in his act. He said, "Heroes ain't born, they're cornered." Well, Jim Garrison was cornered when he accidentally began to read the Warren Report, and it seems to me that you were cornered by the truths that you uncovered. Has anybody approached you about the possibility of either making a documentary, like this guy Moore with the cowboy hat? Has he come to you to make a documentary, or has anybody come from Hollywood to make a film about Methodical Deception?
Yes, I am working with a very interested Hollywood producer who claims that there's a lot of people in Hollywood that would like to get the truth out about this. I know there's a lot of people there that would like to prevent it from coming out as well, because of who it does bring into the picture. A foreign military and foreign intelligence agencies. And yes, and so, and someone is interested to do a documentary, and I've actually been asked to be a consultant with a group of people, and some of them I know you know, so on a film. And I'm not sure exactly, I'm assuming that's a documentary type film. It isn't specifically about me, but I'll be making sure that they get everything right.
That's wonderful. Absolutely and totally wonderful, because it is a whole lot easier in this day and age for people to sit and watch a visual than it is to read a book. And you're to be commended for the books, first of all, and the fact that you're still out there every day talking about it. And the information in Methodical Deception, those photographs that you captured of those art students in the building, and the passes that they had. Why is it that this information is available to you, a former flight attendant, and yet none of this kind of stuff ever came up in that so-called investigation that they have?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm just shocked that the information about the Israeli art students, some of them were Mossad agents and bomb experts that were living in the 91st floor of the World Trade Center Tower. I found that in a DEA report, and it's linked to my website for methodicaldeception.com. You can go there and read the resources pages and follow about the artists, and the DEA report is there, including their numbers, their ID numbers, their military ID. Like, for us, it's a like social security type number, but a military ID and information about them, about being ordnance or bomb experts and working with the Israeli Defense Forces. And some of those traveling artists that the DEA reports about actually ended up living inside the 91st floor with the Lower Manhattan Cultural Center artists from Austria called the Gelatin. And all of that information's on that webpage too, if you just follow the resources. And another thing I just want to mention real quickly, John, is that I dedicated the Methodical Deception, I don't know if you noticed, to the crew of the USS Liberty.
I saw that. That was very touching.
I'm happy to say that I'm getting contacted every day by people who never had heard of it, and they didn't even know it had happened, and have gone in and researched it, and they now know that that attack was the first false flag that we experienced as a nation by our best friends. So it's interesting that a lot of
that best friend being Israel. But you saw, right now, there are about 90% of the American people do not believe that John F. Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald alone, or if at all. And there has been a lot of outrage for 50-some-odd years about that solved crime that has not really been solved publicly. This is so much more horrible, what happened to the Twin Towers with 3,000 people being slaughtered. How was the government capable, or who was capable, of halting the public's outrage and the prevention of a real investigation? I mean, even George Bush wouldn't testify, and he wanted Henry Kissinger, that fascist who killed Allende in Chile, to head it up. But there was so much outrage from the families that they didn't want Kissinger there. What happened that thing was stopped?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I've uncovered some serious involvement with people high up in politics and in the Central Intelligence Agency. And this stuff cannot be denied. It's in their own documentation. So for me, what I kept saying that morning, John, when I was watching it unfold on television, was, how did they take control of our military? How did they stop NORAD from responding and scrambling jets? The Strategic Air Command is what I called it when I grew up. I know they've changed the name now to be alert bases, but I was like, what happened to our planes? What happened to NORAD? How did someone living in a cave in Afghanistan take control of our military? Well, they didn't. Our military was involved with it. And I can show you that in their own documents, actually. So hopefully I'll live long enough to get that third book out. And one of the things I wanted to mention, I know we don't have a lot of time, but this thing that's going on in Paris, I think a lot of people are starting to see similarities with 9/11, like the paper passports surviving a suicide bomb. Their passport flew out of their pocket and before the bomb went off, I guess. I mean, this is nonsensical stuff, but I want to just draw your attention to this because I just came across it. It's from Paul Craig Roberts, and he is an extremely well-placed person, and he has received a report from European security that a massive cyber attack on French systems happened 48 hours prior to and during the attacks in Paris. Now, this is important because this is something that the ISIS people that they're blaming had absolutely no capability of doing. This then leads to a state-sponsored, and you can look this up, Unit 8200 Signal Intelligence, Israeli Mossad, is written all over this, just like on 9/11, how they commandeered the airlines. United and American lost their phone lines and their internet service that morning in the middle of all of this crisis. Coincidentally. And so you're going to see a lot of similarities, like the flags at half-mast for something that happened. But you notice when Russia lost 224 people in a plane crash, we didn't lower our flags and paint everything up in red, white, and blue for their flag and all of that nonsense. We didn't have a moment of silence on NFL games. And we are being manipulated again to go to war. People better wake up.
Paul Craig Roberts, former, I think, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan, is one of the really great voices on the internet. I've had him on the show a couple of times. I have enormous respect and admiration for that man. And as for what happened in Paris, why is it that it's so blatant. Netanyahu, a little while ago, there's a video flying around viral with Netanyahu saying that France is going to pay dearly for recognizing Palestine which they did on December 2nd.
And they also, I understand, they refused to sign the TIPP, the TPP, the trade agreement that's been pushed through as well, and that's favoring, of course, Israel and China. As Trump said, it's going to destroy the rest of what's left of our country. And this is something Obama's pushing, but I guess France has refused to sign that. And I think they're against GMOs, too, so they're not playing the game. And also, if you notice that there was a Spanish judge that put out an arrest warrant for Bibi Netanyahu just a couple days ago.
Never heard about it here. The other story that I just got from a friend in Thailand, for crying out loud, my computer guru, he sent me an article about the fact that one of the Rothschilds was going to be arrested in France and tried for something. Yeah. And then from a couple of years ago, it started to reemerge, Rebecca. And I don't know if it's real or not. Perhaps you know, because so many things are photoshopped on the internet. But it's a few Israelis, I think they were some of the arts students that were deported back to Israel, were on a television show in Tel Aviv. And the translation was that they were sent to New York to record the disaster. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. And they were the five dancing Israelis that the woman in New Jersey turned in. And there's actually on YouTube, you can just search five dancing Israelis. And there's also a YouTube out now that with the police officer from New Jersey that arrested them. And here's what they said. Palestinians are your problem, not us. We're your friends. But they were, in fact, and they are on internet or on the television in Israel, saying that they were sent to document the 9/11 event. They were sent from Israel. So someone in Israel knew what was coming down. And also, don't forget the Odigo text message service that notified 4,000 American Jews that were signed up for Odigo text messaging service. They were told by a text message to not go into the World Trade Center towers that morning.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And, you know, there was a lady from Israel who was on Democracy Now! Last year. And she said that one of the best defenses that they had, and she's a member of their Knesset, I guess, she said one of the best defenses we have in America is that anybody criticizes the media, which is owned, 96% of all American media is owned by six corporations, and each one of these heads of these corporations happen to be Jewish. She says, but if you mention that, she says, we attack you for being anti-Semitic, so it shuts up any conversation or any confrontation or any truth finding. And she said it on Democracy Now!
Well, that's very true. And they've been very successful at that. But thankfully, the world is waking up. And you'll remember in Methodical Illusion, I put in the attack that was overheard in the tape recorder pen. That's real. And I read it on Ynet News out of Israel a couple years back. And it was what I consider to be the next false flag in this country. And since we just had a false flag in Paris, this is worth reading. And I've got YouTube on my YouTube channel, which is just Rebecca Roth channel on YouTube. YouTube's called Could This Be the Next False Flag? And I read it just like now Israel is saying that they had intelligence that Paris was going to get attacked. They tried to tell the French, but I'm just telling you that for 48 hours they had a cyber attack, according to Paul Craig Roberts. But the attack was five or six major cities in the United States using biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons over a 9-day period. If they do that, we're done, because everyone will be a suspect. We will be under total martial law, and they will have control, and they can blame it on Iran or Syria or China or Russia or anyone else they want to go to war with.
Rebecca, please tell us where folks can listen to you on Saturday. Tell us where they can buy your book.
You can
also tell us about that sort of conversation you're going to have that you mentioned to me when we were not on the air earlier about this lady that you're going to be interviewing.
Oh, yeah. This coming Saturday, I'm going to be joined by another senior flight attendant and international purser, and we're going to talk for 2 hours about 9/11, about the airline industry, and and how our lives were affected by 9/11. And you can find me on talknetwork.com Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. And it's for 2 hours. We'll be chit-chatting. You can get my books autographed from three websites, methodicalillusion.com, methodicaldeception.com, and RebeccaRoth.com. And it's spelled RebeccaRoth.com. You can get a link to the a secure online store and get your books autographed. And they ship out in usually 2 to 3 days. So it might say it takes longer, but that's because the store hasn't been updated.
Well,
so,
I'm going to tell you something, Rebecca. Nothing is going to happen to you. Physically, nothing will happen to you. And the reason for that is I remember Jim Garrison early telling Mort Saul, who was one of the investigators who knew Robert Kennedy very well. This was after the death, of course, of John Kennedy. And Mr. Garrison was urging Mort Saul to get Robert Kennedy to go public, because he said, if the man goes public, he'll save his life. You have gone extremely public. And also, I think about this. Did you ever see the movie Viva Zapata with Marlon Brando?
No, I haven't.
It is a great, great film. One of Brando's, he had made three great movies, and this was one of them. And at the end, Zapata is betrayed by his friends and murdered. Now, that's a terrible way for Ilya Kazan to end an award-winning, outstanding movie, but you don't get sad because of the imagery. His favorite horse was a white horse. They always have a white horse. And the white horse is riding off into the mountains, and they said, the voiceover said, the truth will live on. You have these magnificent books. You have all these magnificent recordings of all these shows that you've done. That will live on, believe me. But nothing is going to happen to you, and I'll be listening to you this Saturday, and I want you to thank you very, very much for your courage. Thank you for being here, dear.
Well, thank you for having me, John. It's been my pleasure.
Bye, and good luck. We'll be right back after this brief break with one of my dearest friends, Joe Satilli.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
I love you. Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back. I'd like to thank George for the very wonderful unsolicited review of The Last Word on the assassination, which you can Google on Amazon. Also, while you're up there, you'll find 70 to 100 unbelievable unsolicited reviews. And it's in the top 15 of Amazon, only word to mouth. But I got to tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. Come November 22nd, which is only 6 days away from now, and Joe Satilli can verify this, you're going to see one of the most thrilling 70 minutes about Mr. Garrison and John Kennedy that you have ever seen. Anyway, I want to introduce to me the brightest, journalist, the best informed journalist I know. He puts out the best newsletter every day. It's called News Vandal, and it's extremely objective and always unbelievably well informing. And he's got a new gig. His name is Joe Satilli. He's from the Golden State with that golden voice. Joe, welcome back to the show. Thank you.
Yes, it is true. I am a natural born Californian, so don't hold that against me. And I will be a regular on Chuck Ocelli's show, The Ocelli Effect. I think if you just Google that, you'd come up with it. I'll be doing that Tuesdays, second hour, which is 6 o'clock Pacific time from 6 to 7 to talk about various and sundry. And boy, I have to tell you, Rebecca Roth, what clarity in her voice, not just her voice, but in her purpose. I'm not saying that I'm going to believe everything that she says wholesale, but boy, she makes a compelling case. And I think the thing that I found most interesting is this idea of false flag, because we have had the Paris attacks. And of course, the machinery starts to go and people start to ask questions, and it's great to ask questions. And there are many questions about 9/11. I mean, you know, one thing that Rebecca Roth doesn't bring up, but I'm sure it's not because she hasn't looked at it. It's just because there's so much information to give. The thing that I always found fascinating were the put options on American Airlines and United Airlines in the days and hours before the attack happened. And somebody made a lot of money through A.B. Brown, Deutsche Bank, and there's a whole history there for A.B. Brown going back to Brown Brothers and Brown Brothers Harriman and the Dulles Brothers all the way back. And, you know, when the commission looked at that issue, what they said in the report was, well, we looked at the issue and we found out who was responsible for the put options, but we didn't think it was a politically important or a politically viable thing to talk about. Well, I don't know. I kind of think that that's kind of important. You mean somebody profited off of what was anticipated to be a sudden precipitous decline in the value of these two stocks, of these two specific airlines? I always thought that was interesting. And, you know, when you get to this idea of false flags, I'm not saying that Paris is a false flag. I don't really see any reason to call it a false flag, because I think one of the fascinating things about where we are is that false flags are almost not even necessary anymore. The Hornets, nest has been beaten with a baseball bat so many times, and it is so hard to know in this double blind, triple blind world of covert operations who is triggering who and who is responsible for activating a cell. You almost can never really find out. But in terms of false flags, I think one of the things that's interesting is that historically speaking, it's actually not unusual. In 1931, the Japanese invaded China on something called the Mukden incident, or the Mukden Bridge, or the Manchurian Bridge incident, where Japanese soldiers dressed up as Chinese shot at themselves and used that to justify the invasion of Manchuria. Then, of course, there's the phony war against Poland, where Nazi soldiers went across the border dressed in Polish uniforms, shot back at their Nazi brethren, and that was used to justify the invasion of Poland. Of course, John, do you remember the Maine?
Absolutely.
Well, if you remember the Maine, you might remember something that all mainstream historians now say is that in 1898, when the Maine was sunk and became the justification for the Spanish-American War and the capturing of vital coaling stations for the American Navy in the South Pacific, including capturing the Philippines, that it was not a terrorist bombing, as it was called by William Randolph Hearst's newspapers at the time, by Cuban nationals. It was actually either a boiler fire that caused an explosion, or the U.S. forces bombed it themselves. That's pretty much mainstream history right now.
Well, you can go to Operation Northwoods, which was
– and then there's Northwoods.
So tell the folks about Operation Northwoods.
Well, Northwoods – and, John, I don't know where you come down on this. There are some people who believe that Northwoods may have been – the final straw that led to the death of Kennedy, because
it played a major part in it.
Played a major part, because General Lemnitzer, they had such a, and since you went there already at the beginning with your opening, You know, the military-industrial complex had such a hard-on to go into Cuba. They were so desperate to get into Cuba. They came up with a plan, and this Operation Northwoods plan was multifaceted, but what it was, and it was chaired and signed by General Lemnitzer. What the idea was, they were going to do a number of things. They were going to take a plane, a mock plane, and it was going to be remotely controlled. Folks, this is 1962. They were going to remotely control a plane that was going to be mocked up to be sort of a chartered plane, supposedly carrying American students to go do good works in South and Central America, and it was going to be shot down by the Cubans. It was going to be blaming the Cubans. Actually, the plan says the plane will be remotely controlled, landed, and the people will be taken off of the plane. It will be replaced, and we will claim that it was shot down. There will also be faked, coordinated terrorist attacks in Miami and Washington, D.C. that can then be blamed on the Cubans. That would, according to this plan, justify in the minds of the American population a full-scale military invasion of Cuba. Basically, Kennedy said, you're out of your frickin' mind. Lemnitzer was asked to resign along with Dulles. So here he is, Kennedy. Two things related to Cuba. One, I'm sorry, Alan Dulles. I know that you have ties into the Wall Street.
Very quickly, you mentioned Alan Dulles. Your friend David Talbot has a very, very interesting book out about Alan Dulles' involvement in the assassination.
Yeah, The Devil's Chessboard. And as Talbot points out, even though Dulles had been fired by Kennedy after trying to basically trap Kennedy, the newly inaugurated Kennedy, into an invasion in Cuba, and Kennedy said, no, sorry, Alan, you're going to have to go. Even though he was no longer a part of the CIA, for some reason over the three-day period around Kennedy's murder, I like to say murder more than assassination sometimes.
Yes, it was a murder. It was a murder, a very public murder. And Alan Dulles was where during those 3 days?
Here he went to Northern Virginia to a known CIA bunker, even though he was no longer in the CIA. For some reason, he spent 3 days in the bunker. We don't know.
I want to get back to Paris for just a second, because I'm going to tell you something amazing about Rebecca Roth. And it just occurred to me, and it may have occurred to you, she is the only person I have ever heard who could talk factually and honestly about what happened to the USS Liberty and what happened on 9/11 and not sound anti-Semitic. She sounds maybe cautious about we should be careful about our friend Israel, but she never comes across as anti-Semitic. And the other thing that she pointed out, two things, because you say some of the stuff you may not buy, but when you see the documentation, for example, when she said this business about the text that these people got, 4,000 Jews don't go into work today, that's out there in print, as are some of the warnings from a couple of FBI offices that John Kennedy should not come to Dallas on November 22nd. They are in print, but something very similar happened that we have not heard about except from Rebecca, and that is the total media electronic blackout in Paris the day that this happened, because the same thing happened in Washington, D.C. The entire phone system shut down. Now, the government tried to say, well, there were too many phone calls to the White House, but it wasn't. The system was just shut down.
Well, see, here's the thing. And I think the difference between the Kennedy assassination and then, of course, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, which to me, these are really, really sloppy events. And John, this is a question I've always wanted to ask you. Have you ever wondered why they even allowed the Zapruder film to get into the Time Life vault in the first place?
I said, as you saw in the film that's going to come out on the 22nd, that I offered Dan Rather's people $25,000 so I could sit down with them and talk to them about that.
But why would they even allow that to exist? It's the ultimate smoking gun. It's the thing that really unravels the case, you know, as Oliver Stone did over and over again, back and to the left, back and to the left, back and to the left. It's because I feel they actually wanted you you, the American people, and they wanted anybody else running for president to know that they could do it and get away with it.
That is exact. When we did the last word on the assassination a year ago, January at UNLV, an 18-year-old boy stood up and he said, you know, I'm not as smart as you people, but please, could somebody tell me, and I believe, and the young man said, I believe the Central Intelligence Agency killed our president. This is from an 18-year-old, for crying out loud. Why was it so public? And Jim Mars and Joan Mellon said exactly the same thing that you said, that it was a public execution for the next president to know. And, you know, Bill Hicks sadly died. He could have been.
Yes.
Oh, my God. He could have been the biggest comic in the world. He was so bright. He made that comment years ago about the president, after he's elected, is brought over to CIA headquarters at Langley and shown a film of the assassination by the CIA from another angle. It is so brilliant. And I offered one that, you know, he died when he was 32 of cancer, and I just wondered, God, did he really get cancer? I mean,
yeah, well, you see, this is the thing, is that we know, the thing is that if you look at the dark side, if you look at, and not Cheney's dark side, but in some ways it is the same thing as Cheney's dark side that he was talking about. But if you look at these covert operations and how these covert operations work and the symmetry with which they work, the playbook that seems to be in place, you obviously become suspicious of just about everything. But there is a point at which it's now a matter of whether it's benign neglect or malicious neglect. I think malicious neglect has a lot to do with a lot of these situations that you find yourself in. You know, on some level, if you know an attack is coming, why stop it if it can become a valuable way of achieving other ends? Which I think if you look at 9/11 and you look at the fact that Dick Cheney and the Energy Commission, before 9/11 ever happened, in the wake of the California energy crisis, when all of a sudden America had this massive energy crisis, we are going to need a lot of oil. Well, he formed an energy commission, and Judicial Watch subpoenaed, FOIA'd and subpoenaed the documents and found that Cheney and Halliburton, all those guys, were poring over oil maps of Iraq before 9/11 ever happened. You have to wonder if they thought or knew Bin Laden determined attack in the United States. You don't even have to go to all of the extensive planning. Isn't it enough if they knew it was coming and just let it happen to then condemn them and put them on trial and hopefully put them in jail?
And then the day before 9/11, the Secretary of Defense comes on television and tells us that $2 or $3 trillion is missing from the Pentagon. 9/11 happens. Building 7 goes down, where the investigation was not even hit by, just hit by Warren Spoke.
Well, in Building 7, where the SEC had about 40,000 records of active investigations into Wall Street, that goes. I mean, Building 7 really is the ultimate anomaly of this entire thing, because there are all the different interesting little things that go on, and you can talk about the side of the Pentagon. I was actually driving into Washington, D.C. when the attack on the Pentagon happened, and I watched the cloud come off of it. And the side of the Pentagon that was hit was the one side of the Pentagon that was being reinforced to prevent a terrorist attack, which meant that it was underpopulated because most of the offices were there, which is why the death toll was so low on that side of the Pentagon. So, you know, all of these fascinating little coinkydinks, right?
Joe, well, listen, you're going to get to talk about a lot of this. Tell us, first of all, where people can get your News Vandal, and when you'll be working with Chuck. And then I want to take a minute between you and me to plug John Barber's last word on the Garrison tapes, which is going to be launched this Sunday, November 22nd. So
very easy. If you want to get the News Vandal rundown, email me at info, I-N-F-O, at newsvandal, NEWSVANDAL, newsvandal.com. Just put sign up in the subject line and you'll get it every Monday through Friday early in the morning. It's pretty much the most it's drawn from everything. You will get a good idea what's going on in the world just from reading the headlines. I will be with Chuck Ocelli every Tuesday night starting at 6 p.m. Pacific time for an hour beginning tomorrow. Just put in I think it's the Ocelli effect, O-C-H-E-L-L-I, Ocelli effect. And John, everybody's got to get on board with this. You want to make a follow-up to the Garrison tapes. It's the second assassination of John F. Kennedy, how the media really covered up and how the media has made a concerted effort to keep the facts about the Kennedy assassination away from the American public. There is a GoFundMe page that you've put up. There's an Indiegogo page that you put up. And when people see the 70-minute interview that Leno Sonic did with you about this, they will be compelled to help you make this next film.
Well, you know, a lot of these, and I must tell you, I think once you're on Chuck's show for a while, which is the same network that Rebecca's on, you will deservedly have your own show. And the interesting thing about all of this is all of this came about by accident. I've been working for years, hoping that I would get enough funds, but still doing research on the Garrison Tapes Part 2, the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. When Leno Sonic comes down here out of the blue and puts me on camera just to ask me to tell my story about how I got involved. And then I saw the finished film and I got so excited. I think this is as good or better than the Garrison Tapes. Of course, Len says no, because the Garrison Tapes is part of history. And I say no, but I'm still alive. And this is really amazing, thrilling story. So we just posted on Facebook asking people to send the information to their friends on November 22nd. And already people are sending in contributions and they haven't even seen the trailer, which will go up in one day. So I urge any of you, gather your family, gather your friends. I don't care if you don't care about the murder of John Kennedy. If you care about a really great American story, you watch John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes this Sunday, November 22nd. And I assure you, neither you, your family, or your friends will ever be the same or think the same about the American media. Joe, thank you for being here. Good luck.
Always a pleasure.
I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you all, folks. I'll talk to you after Sunday, November 22nd. Thank you so much. Good luck and goodbye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.